This is Marketplace Money for the weekend of December 4th, 2009. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, supporting financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide since 1937. Putnam, a world of investing.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money. For most high school seniors, the hard work of getting into college is done. Applications and essays are in the mail. Now they wait, and they worry. Not just about getting in, but about how they're going to pay for it if they do. The Project on Student Debt said this week that graduates owe an average of more than $23,000 when they leave school. With so many students taking on bigger loans, you might think lenders would be begging for their business. But Bank of America just joined a growing list of financial firms no longer accepting student loan applications. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon tells us banks are leaving the business to their rich uncle.
If you've borrowed money for college from a bank or other financial institution lately, you can almost certainly thank Uncle Sam. The government has had to fill the gap as private funding has dried up. Now the Obama administration wants to eliminate the cost of the middleman and make loans directly. Scott Peterson is a grad student at Dominican University outside Chicago, and he says he'd welcome doing business directly with the government since he's never understood the way things work now.
Well, it just doesn't make that much sense to me, basically. I mean, I'm getting federal money to help me go to school, but a private firm is basically just taking money from the government with one hand and giving it to me with the other.
Federal officials say they want to streamline a confusing bureaucracy. Bob Shireman is Deputy Undersecretary of Education. He says the government should handle the application process and make loans borrowers can count on.
We need to be able to tell families and students that their loans are going to be there. And moving in this direction allows us to confidently say that families will have access to loans.
But the plan is facing fierce opposition from free market proponents. Take this jab, posted on YouTube by the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
We at the federal government are proposing an entire takeover of the student loan industry. The Student Aid and Fiscal Responsibility Act of 2009 would give us the power to decide your educational future. Please give us the power, because we're the federal government, and we should control everything.
The direct loan idea has already passed the House and is nearing a Senate vote, likely by next month. And with the writing on the wall, some financial institutions are already abandoning the student loan business. Lately, a few panicked listeners have written in, wondering if they'll be able to get loans for college in the meantime. Kevin Bruns heads the industry group America's Student Loan Providers. He says there's still plenty of student loan money and lots of ready lenders.
There has not been a single student in this country that has not been able to get a guaranteed student loan throughout this credit crisis.
His group warns that thousands of financial jobs are threatened by the federal student loan takeover, but the Education Department's Bob Shireman says private enterprise would still get a piece of the pie.
We make the loan directly and then contract with the private companies to do the collection on these loans. So it's really moving from a government loan program to a government loan program, but run in a different kind of way.
The kind of way that the loan industry's Kevin Brun says would kill healthy competition among private lenders.
If there's no longer any incentive at the retail level to do a good job and to invest in making this process more convenient, what will happen to the service levels? Where will I go then? Well, you won't have anywhere to go.
The government already has a limited direct lending option. Education Secretary Arne Duncan bragged about it to financial aid officers in Nashville this week.
We had independent surveys, customer satisfaction surveys, and they found that service in the direct loan program is comparable to or better than that coming from the financial services companies.
Whatever Congress decides, the government and industry leaders we spoke to say lawmakers won't leave students in the lurch. And one financial aid counselor told me borrowers shouldn't notice much change, because whether it's a public or private loan, the money's still green. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace Money.
Not only are college students taking on more loans to pay for their educations, they're also graduating into one of the worst job markets in recent history. But at least there's this. The government says 11,000 workers lost their jobs last month, instead of the hundreds of thousands we've been seeing, and the unemployment rate now stands at 10%. Some laid-off employees are lucky enough to be offered something called outplacement services. It's training and counseling meant to help you transition to the next stage of your working life. China Gorman is with the Society for Human Resource Management, and I asked her what kind of advice people are hearing from outplacement counselors these days.
I think the basics have remained the same, but it takes a lot more focus and gumption to be in the job market today as a job seeker? Because just as you've said, every piece of information out there tells you from every source that there are no jobs, which of course would not be true. There are, in fact, lots of jobs. It's just harder to find them, and it takes sometimes guerrilla tactics. It takes creativity and innovation to find the next right spot, whether it's a full-time position like the one they left, or it's a contract position, which is becoming more and more the norm these days, or it's time to retool your career, go back to school. The big difference now, as opposed to a year ago or 2 years ago or 3 years ago, it's harder. It takes more work. It takes more focus.
I love the idea of guerrilla tactics in trying to find a new job. Can you give us a couple of examples of that?
Well, a year ago, I would have told you that using social media to create your personal visibility and to grow your network would be a guerrilla tactic.
Now that's just obvious, right?
Today you must. But guerrilla tactics would include not just responding to a job board posting, but developing a plan to meet the right people, to gain that professional and personal visibility.
So are you talking about, what, ambushing them at the local Starbucks?
No, I don't mean that kind of guerrilla tactic. I mean, really, what professional associations do they belong to, and can you bump into them at a meeting? And it might, you know what, it might be bumping into them at the Starbucks if your data gathering is that good and you know that they stop at that Starbucks on the way to work in the morning. You know, that might exactly work for you.
I understand that about 40% of workers who have access to outplacement services don't use them. Why do you think that is?
It's because, for the most part, they're uneducated consumers. Outplacement doesn't make a lot of sense, I think, to the average employee in the population. The outcome, the specific outcome, is that a job seeker knows how to go about placing themselves in the economy in a new way, whether it's a full-time job or starting a business or going back to school or retiring.
If you've lost your job and you don't have outplacement offered to you, do you have any tips for folks, you know, things that they can take from the concept of outplacement and try to do it on their own?
Sure. There are many community and faith-based organizations that are providing job search support, and some of those programs are really top-notch. In the public sector, the one-stop career centers, many of them also do a very fine job of providing similar kinds of services for free. They just have to do some homework. They have to do a little bit of research and find out what the options are in their community.
Janet Gorman is an executive with the Society for Human Resource Management. Thank you so much for your help today.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Marketplace Money is supported by Bank of America, which has begun a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities. And by Constant Contact, helping small businesses stay connected to their customers with email marketing and online surveys. Over 300,000 small businesses and nonprofits use ConstantContact.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Next week marks 1 year since the arrest of a Wall Street titan. A man who once served as chairman of the NASDAQ, a prominent philanthropist, someone whose investment firm was so wildly successful that clients never bothered to check the books. Bernie Madoff is now serving a 150-year prison term after pleading guilty earlier this year to the biggest Ponzi scheme in U.S. history. David McPherson is head of the financial planning firm Four Ponds Financial, and I asked whether he thinks we've all learned our lesson, or will we see more Ponzi schemes down the line?
Sadly, there will always be cases like this. It's, I guess, human nature. But I do believe that individual investors are, you know, being more careful in showing a healthy degree of skepticism that maybe they weren't a year ago.
Is it possible to say where you should begin your skepticism? I mean, when you're looking at your returns, how do you know what is too good to be true?
Well, the best thing I think any individual can do is basically adopt the attitude, you know, trust but verify. Hmm. I think if you're working with a financial advisor, even if you have total confidence in them, you should be looking over their shoulder You know, that's what I actually encourage my clients to do. You know, I don't want them to have the least bit of doubt as to what I'm doing. And so I encourage them to check their statements and look at their accounts online to see what kind of activities taking place. I think that's probably the single best defense is to monitor things, no matter how much faith you have in your advisor.
Well, if you're telling your clients to be looking over your shoulder, can you give us an idea of what kinds of questions investors should be asking to make sure they are not being duped?
Well, the first question you should ask an advisor that you're going to work with is, who's my custodian? Now, a custodian is an independent third-party firm that actually holds your assets, so that the advisor might be managing the account, but they shouldn't also at the same time have custody of your assets.
All right. Question number two.
Question number two is, how do I check my accounts online? Hmm. You know, personally, I wouldn't do any business with a firm that doesn't provide you with online access to your accounts.
But what about the investors who say, look, I don't know that even if I had access and was able to look online, that I would know what I should be looking for?
Right. What I would look for is any signs of money being removed from the account. Hmm. Now, there are many legitimate reasons why money would be coming out of the account. But look at specifically the signs that money came out of the account, and then, you know, try to figure out what was the reason for that.
You know, it really sounds to me like if we're looking at the broad lesson, it's that you've got to have your hands in your investments. You've got to be paying attention and have at least a mildly active role in what's happening with your accounts.
Certainly. I mean, I don't think you want to be totally hands-off because, after all, it's your money.
But wasn't that the case with quite a few of Madoff's clients?
Yeah, I mean, they you know, many of them were hands-off, but, you know, they were also getting statements that were misleading, so it may have been hard for some of them to detect what was going on. Now, maybe you're not comfortable making investment decisions, and that's why they go to a third party.
Right.
But even if that's the case, you should, you know, still be looking at the statements, going online just to see what's happening. And, you know, many times you'll have questions that are entirely legitimate and the activity is legitimate, but you should have some idea of how your accounts operate.
David McPherson is a personal finance commentator and the founder of Four Ponds Financial in Massachusetts. Thanks so much for your help today.
Thank you, Tess.
Ponzi schemes get a lot of attention, but lots of people fall for even simpler financial fantasies.
They very carefully over and over again repeat the phrase, if you have no balance at the end of the month, it costs you nothing.
The fact and fiction of debt cancellation. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. After all the hype and headlines surrounding Bernie Madoff, you'd think people would realize that making money and investing it are not simple things to do. If they were, we'd all be rich. But as Marketplace's Rico Galliano found out, some lessons are very hard to teach.
The story begins with a marketing firm called Tube Mogul. Among other things, they offer a free service that lets anyone track how well their videos are faring on YouTube. And earlier this year, Tube Mogul director David Birch noticed an odd bunch of people signing up for the free service.
I was looking at their email addresses, and it was like, Wealth Builders, 1234. And they would always use the word cash gifts, cash gift to get rich, cash gifting, that kind of stuff. And I had no idea what that meant, really.
So he searched for YouTube videos tagged with those phrases and found he'd stumbled upon a huge subculture of homemade get-rich-quick videos.
Here comes the money!
Here we go!
This is a typical cash gifting video. It's a single shot of a guy in his living room talking right into the camera.
Hey, this is Rob from Mississippi again. It's Monday morning.
Eventually, he takes out a sealed overnight delivery envelope. Forgive the sound quality. Like I say, this is homemade.
This was dropped off about 15 minutes ago by UPS. And inside the package here, there should be a $3,500 cash gift. And so all I want to do is open it up here.
Guess what? The package is stuffed with cash.
It's 35 $100 bills that was sent to me by an individual that I spoke to over the weekend.
At first, Tube Mogul's David Birch found these videos puzzling, but kind of funny. Then he realized how many there were. Right now, he says there are about 5,000 of them on YouTube alone, racking up a massive 21 million views. And then he got concerned.
Some of them would even describe what sounded like a very straightforward pyramid scheme. They'd say stuff like, you send me $100, you join the network, and then you get 100 people to join the network, and then you are rich in a week. They'd say stuff like that, and I'm like, huh, is it a pyramid scheme if they're being honest that it's a pyramid scheme?
The answer, yes, it is.
It's a pyramid scheme. At the end of the day, it's a pyramid scheme.
See, I told you. That's Allison Southwick of the Better Business Bureau. The Bureau checked out the cash gifting phenomenon and quickly realized it's the latest wrinkle on an old scam.
Cash gifting really sprung up in the 90s. It really flourished among already established communities such as women's circles or church groups, and they were often called gifting clubs or dinner parties or even investment clubs.
Some gifting clubs even portrayed themselves as charities dedicated to changing members' lives. They'd give their groups names like Women Empowering Women. But those clubs and the new ones online all have one thing in common: their methods. Karen Hobbs is an attorney for the Federal Trade Commission.
New members are instructed to give cash gifts, which are funneled to the highest ranking club members. The new club members are promised that, look, if you get additional members to join the club, you're going to rise to the top and you'll receive big money.
As your team grows, so do your residual cash gifts for life.
It's a textbook pyramid scheme, and it's 100% illegal, no matter how much cash gifters insist otherwise.
One thing that a cash gifter will try to get you to believe is that it is legal to do this, that you can write this donation, this gift off on your taxes.
But just because you can legally write off a gift doesn't mean it's legal to use gifts as part of a pyramid scheme. Which leads me to ask, since it's so clearly a crime, why are thousands of people so brazenly promoting cash gifting online?
I think that they are depending on the internet, which is a very quick, very anonymous method of scamming people out of money. The theory would be to get your word out there, grab what you can, and then go back offline.
Scammers are also helped along by shame. The FTC received only 1,800 complaints about pyramid schemes last year. Hobbs says many victims are embarrassed to admit they've been conned. And some cash gifters simply refuse to believe it's a con. David Birch remembers getting a call from a client. He'd shut down her TubeMogul account after he found she was using it in a cash gifting scheme.
She was so convinced that it wasn't a scam. She didn't get that it was a scam, and I sort of tried to point her, you know, like, hey, I don't think this is right. And she just sounded like this desperate woman who'd lost everything she'd ever have, and I felt so bad.
Delinquency rates, they're accelerating, they're not getting better. Foreclosure rates are accelerating, they're not getting better.
This is another cash gifting video I found online. Over mournful music, TV news clips rattle off a laundry list of recent bad economic news.
Consumer income is down, and their jobs are going away. There's no signs of job stabilization yet.
Then, halfway through, titles tell viewers there's hope. A, quote, community that provides a gateway to prosperity. Doesn't that sound nice? A welcoming tribe who'll magically make hard times vanish? With the American dream further out of reach, it's easy to see how cash gifters can sell some people on a pipe dream. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace Money.
So there you have it. No cash gifting. Unless it's a holiday card that grandma filled with a few crisp dollar bills. But what about all those other too-good-to-be-true offers that so many people keep falling for and falling for? Here's an example. What if someone promised that for a small fee, if you got laid off, injured, or fired, all your debts would be forgiven? Poof! They're gone. And the offer is coming from your credit card company. Bob Sullivan covers internet scams and consumer fraud for MSNBC.com, and he recently wrote about something called debt cancellation service. I asked for a simple explanation of what this is.
Well, it's a new kind of insurance. Probably everyone who has a credit card at some point in their life got one of those inserts which offered some way of getting out of your bill if you died or lost your job. Up until about 10 years ago, it was called credit insurance. Mm-hmm. But the banks have figured out that they can make a lot more money if they essentially offer the insurance themselves. So now they call it debt cancellation. It's not regulated by insurance boards anymore around the country. And what you do is you pay a dollar or two a month per $100 in balance. And if something bad happens to you, the bank promises to pay your bills for you under certain conditions. But it's really not a good deal for consumers because the costs add up very quickly. A $3,000 balance can be $60 a month.
Yikes.
There's lots of other insurance products that help you with this that can be cheaper. And as you might imagine, there's a lot of red tape that you have to go through to actually claim the benefit.
Now, you used an inside source for your story, someone who actually works at a telemarketing firm and sells this stuff. Talk to us about what kinds of practices he described to you that are used to get people to sign up for this.
I think the real problem with debt cancellation, if you look on the internet, you'll just see complaints all over the place from people who get this service and don't even realize that they have it.
Hmm.
So they buy something at a store, or they sign up for one of those one-year same-as-cash deals when they buy a big television. And next thing you know, they're paying $20, $30 a month for something they don't even know they signed up for. So how does that happen? I was contacted anonymously by someone who works at a telemarketing company, and folks call him up thinking that they are just simply activating their credit cards, but instead he pushes this service at them using all manner of technique. The one that really irks him and the reason he reached out to me to confess and try to warn people is that the description of how it works and how much it costs sounds a lot like it's free. They very carefully over and over again repeat the phrase, if you have no balance at the end of the month, it costs you nothing. But listen to what I said. It didn't say if you never have any balance at all. On one day of the month picked by the credit card company, they decide how much to charge you for this credit insurance. And even if you pay your bill in full every month, you still pay for this service. So
Wait a minute. You can pay off your bill in full every month, but they pick a day at random so that whatever balance you have on that day, that's what you're going to get charged for?
Well, they wouldn't characterize it as random, but it's the end of the month date, the billing closing date, whatever the date is, but a date that you don't really have access to, that's the date that they file the charges. And so it's basically impossible to have the product and not pay for it, even though over and over again when they make the sales pitch, they sound like there's lots of conditions under which you don't pay anything.
And I want to take you back to something you said earlier, which is that this is something where, you know, all of us who have credit cards, debit cards, you have that sticker on the front that says you have to call this number to activate the card. For some of these situations, when you're calling that number, you're not actually doing it because you have to activate a card. This is so that they can try to sell you something.
That's right. The deck is stacked here in lots of ways. And one of them is when you get this particular kind of credit card, the sticker that's on the front that we're all used to, that we all call compulsively for security reasons,
mm-hmm.
when you call, it's purely a telemarketing phone call. So you think you're activating the card, and right away they say, we're glad you called. Here's the service, and you really should have it. And by the way, it probably won't cost you anything if you don't have a balance at the end of the month. So I'll just sign you up, all right?
So should you never call that number, or are there some cards where you do have to call the number?
See, now this one thing that really irritates me, I've written a lot about identity theft and security, and when companies blend security measures with marketing measures, it really confuses consumers and puts them at great risk.
Yeah.
I would not want to tell any consumer to not call the number on those stickers they get from credit card companies, because normally that's a good security policy. But here we have a company muddying those waters and probably will hurt the security measure in the end.
So you got this story from an anonymous telemarketer. I know that you did call the banks to get their response. Can you share that with us?
Yes. I spent several days going back and forth with the retailer and the banks involved and showed them the scripts that I had. The telemarketer actually shared with me dozens of pages of telephone scripts to back up the claims he was making about how manipulative the conversations were. And their final response was essentially that, if you listen carefully, our descriptions of the product are very clear and unambiguous. We're not doing anything to try to mislead consumers. And this is a situation that I think we see in a lot of sales cases. Think about auto dealerships, for example, where
mm-hmm.
perhaps strictly speaking what they're saying is not illegal or even wrong. But what matters most is the impression that's created, and the impression is created by design, in its case, I think, that the product is free or could be free when it never is.
Bob Sullivan, thanks so much for the cautionary tale.
You bet.
Bob Sullivan of MSNBC.com. If you'd like to read his full blog about debt cancellation, go to our website. It's marketplace.org. While you're there, take a moment and let us know how you're budgeting for the holidays. It can be a very expensive time of year. So how are you handling the pressure to buy, buy, buy?
My
Marketplace Money is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. By Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by Bank of America, which has begun a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
And it's the time in the show when we get to your questions about all kinds of financial matters. And here with me to do that this week is MSN Money columnist Liz Pulliam-Weston. Hi, Liz.
Hi.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Tess.
You ready for some calls?
I think I am.
Okay. Well, first up is Amelia in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi there.
Hello.
What's your question for us today?
Periodically, I receive a letter from my credit card company stating that they have increased my credit access line.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, at this point, it's up to an absurdly high amount of over 10 times of what I would ever charge. It's nearly $22,000.
Whoa! Liz, this is something I have not heard over the last year where credit card companies are automatically increasing credit lines.
Well, they are to some extent when they're very best customers, but everybody else is worried about having credit limits cut, so it's nice to hear the other side.
Oh, so Amelia, apparently you're one of their very best customers.
Well, I always pay my balance in full, but the trouble is I never spend more than maybe $1,500 a month. Mm. So my concern is if my card is stolen, am I liable for this $19,000 that someone might be able to charge? And if I am liable, then I definitely would like my credit card company to reduce this amount. But then am I going to hurt my FICO score or my credit rating?
Couple of great questions here, Liz. First of all, is she liable if this card is stolen?
Here's the great news. No. I mean, by a federal law, you'd be liable for the first $50, but all the major credit cards waive that. So it's lovely that you're concerned, Amelia, about the credit card company's liability, because essentially that's what you're doing. What typically happens is you report the fraudulent purchases as soon as you notice them, and that's why you want to review your statement every month or review your account. The credit card company issues you a new card with a new number, sends it to you, and your life goes on. And that's the end of it and the extent of it. So it's lovely that you're worried for them, but you really don't need to be.
Okay. So basically not your problem. But if she just frankly doesn't want to have this huge credit line that she's never going to use, any disadvantages to closing the card?
Actually, there are. There's a lot of disadvantages to either closing a card or to having your credit limit lowered. Your FICO credit scores look at the gap between the balances you use, that $1,500 you charge every month, even though you pay it off, that $1,500 and your credit limit. They like it when the gap is huge. So the credit scores start to suffer when that gap is lowered. So that's not to say you can never close a card or ask for a lower limit, but I really wouldn't do it if you're in credit score improvement mode or if you don't have a really good reason. And the fact you don't use it, that's actually great. If you use less than 10% of your available limit, that's the best thing for your credit scores.
Probably one thing you don't want to be doing is calling them and saying, lower my limit. You know, I mean, you don't want to call them for any reason other than if you are in real, real trouble, right? Because it's just going to send up some sort of red flag for them.
Yeah, unfortunately, some of the credit card issuers have really lost their minds. And any contact you would have with them seems to be an excuse for them to review your file.
Right.
Now, I don't think Amelia would have as big a problem as somebody that, you know, might have been late once or twice mm-hmm. or might have maxed out their card or had other problems or the credit scores dropped. But I still wouldn't initiate a call if you really don't have to.
So, Amelia, what do you think?
I think I'll leave it as it is.
Yeah. So I think that sounds like the plan for you. Just don't use the $22,000, right?
Oh, I never would. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
All right, Liz, let's go next to an email. And this comes in from Stephanie in Brooklyn, New York. And she called Bank of America.
Oh, brave girl.
Yes, I know. I'm surprised she actually got through. Asked them if she could get a lower interest rate on her current credit card. It's currently 20.24%.
Ouch.
Yeah. Total balance, about $7,000. She says she's never missed a payment, doesn't have a problem making the monthly minimum, but really can't afford much more than that. The representative on the phone actually told her that she qualifies for a hardship program where her interest rate would drop to between 5 and 7%, which is amazing, but the account would be closed. Her credit score is already a little low, so she's worried about whether she should go for this plan and have her card closed. What do you think here? I mean, it certainly sounds like the easier it is for you to go ahead and pay off that balance, if the 5% interest rate is going to get you there,
go for it, right?
Well, a lot of people are worried about that account closure because that can hurt your credit scores. And so they're worried about that. She's got an interesting situation. She doesn't have a good enough credit score probably to get, say, a fixed rate loan from her credit union, which is the thing I normally advise people to do. If they've got a high rate on their credit card and they can't get a 0% or a low rate balance transfer, which it sounds like she can't, the next step is to look at getting these fixed rate loans, because at least you fix the payment. You're done in 3 years and you're out of there, and you can keep the card open because you're transferring the balance to this loan. She's not in that position. She doesn't have a good enough credit score to get that loan. So this might be the next best thing. I do have one real concern, which is she wants to find out how this arrangement will be reported to the credit bureaus. She wants to be crystal clear that there's nothing negative about this being reported to the credit bureaus as she goes along. It can devastate what's left of her credit scores.
So this is something where she needs to call again.
Definitely.
And talk to a representative and find out if there's a catch, basically.
Yeah. This could be a way for her to get rid of this debt and do it more quickly than she might be able to otherwise, because it sounds like she can't make any progress.
Mm-hmm.
But she needs to be extra careful about how this is reported.
Okay. So at this point, she really, the least of her worries is having this account closed.
I would think so at this point. I mean, I hate to see anyone close an account when they don't have to, but sometimes it's the best of bad options.
All right. There you go, Stephanie. Hope that helps. If you've got questions, we are just a phone call away. Give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or write us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at our website. It is marketplace.org. And we'll be back with Liz to take some more questions later in the show. In many careers, the salaries of women still lag behind those of the guys. Maybe it's because we're just so nice.
Basically, they're great employees because they also understand the company's position that, oh, we can't afford to pay you anymore.
The ins and outs of salary negotiation, coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Given everything that's happened in the housing market over the last year or two, you'd think buyers and lenders would be a little more cautious about home affordability. But the Federal Housing Authority has been backing mortgages with 3% down payments given to people with lower credit scores than many lenders required. What? Well, this week, after revealing that it's almost tapped out its reserves, the FHA says it will raise requirements on both the down payment and credit scores. That may very well slow down the meager recovery in housing because fewer home buyers will qualify for a mortgage. But Chris Thornburg of Beacon Economics says the FHA should not be in the business of artificially propping up prices.
Does it mean the housing market is going to tumble a little bit more? Hopefully, yes. Remember, we can still rely on the price mechanism. If you can't afford a house today without a subsidy from Uncle Sam, well, there's a reaction to that, and the reaction that home prices will fall if people can buy them.
Meanwhile, the Treasury Department put more pressure on banks and other lenders this week to modify mortgages of homeowners who are in danger of foreclosing. The government says it will issue fines to lenders who are not helping borrowers permanently reduce the amount owed on their mortgages. We have a link to that effort called the Home Affordable Modification Program on our website. It's marketplace.org. Get back to your questions, and I'm joined once again by MSN Money columnist Liz Pulliam-Weston. Hi again, Liz.
Hi, Tess.
Ready for some more calls?
Ready to go. Let's take it on.
All right. Well, first up, we have David. He's in Tampa, Florida. Hi, David.
Hi.
How can we help you out today?
So I recently changed jobs, started a new IRA portfolio, and I'm fairly new to saving for retirement. I was a grad student for a long time, and we never have any money to do that sort of thing. So I'm looking over the options for my retirement allocation, but the data that I'm seeing on my provider's website is confusing at best, and I think that the financial crisis may have screwed up their models, and so I'm trying to figure out what the best allocation might be for a young investor such as myself, or where to get good information that's not sort of tainted by the financial crisis.
Liz, is there anything that's not tainted by the financial crisis at this point?
I think it would be hard to find. What you have to know, David, is we've been through one of those epically bad periods in the market where stocks essentially haven't gone anywhere for about 10 years. So all the numbers that you're looking at that involve equities look pretty bad. What you need to know going forward, though, is that stocks outperform every other investment over longer time periods. If you look at every 30-year period, if you stayed in there for at least 30 years, you could count on an 8% average annual return. If you've got that long time horizon, which you do have, you can feel fairly comfortable in putting a big chunk of your money into stocks and stock market funds.
David, can I ask how old you are?
I'm 28.
28. He really can afford to take quite a bit of risk, can't he?
Yeah, I'm not one of those that says you should be 100% in stocks because I think very few of us have the stomach for that kind of risk. So at the minimum, I'd say you want to have at least 60% of your portfolio in stocks. You might even bump it up a little bit, 70 or 80%, and make sure you have some exposure to international stocks. And if you're looking for advice, the people you're getting exposed to through your workplace, they may be independent or they may not. So if you want truly independent advice that's personalized to you, a fee-only planner is the way to go.
David, have you ever used one of those?
I haven't, no.
Well, you can do a lot to educate yourself as well. I mean, there's some great books out there. Personal Finance for Dummies, Investing for Dummies. It kind of, you know, you might not like the names of those books, but they really do help break it down and give you a good starting point. And then that session with the planner can help you refine the portfolio you want and refine your goals.
Great. I think that sounds like very good advice. Thank you.
Terrific. Thanks for the call.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And next we have Whitney in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Hi, Whitney.
Hello. How are you?
Very well. And your question for us today?
So my husband and I are actually expecting our first kid this coming April.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. And we're trying to figure out a couple of things. One is just basically saving money for the baby coming and our growing family.
Yes. Well, many, many financial decisions to be making with this with this new arrival. What do you think, Liz?
Yeah, it's so confusing when you have your first kid because you really don't know what you're up against. And it varies so much by family, too. There's a great calculator on the U.S. Department of Agriculture site, of all places. you know, search for it. It's the cost of raising a child. And what you do is you put in where you live, your income bracket, a few other facts, and it will start spitting this information out for you. In general, though, you want to expect your expenses will probably go up about 10% because of the child.
Okay.
So you want to look for ways you can trim other expenses.
10% actually is lower than I would have expected.
Yeah, same.
Well, that doesn't necessarily account for everything. We're not talking college savings there.
Uh-huh.
We may not be talking about child care.
So we're talking diapers, more food in the house.
Basically, I'm talking about food, health insurance, clothing, some of the basic necessities. But rather than overwhelm you... I thought the 10%, you know, rule of thumb would get you started. And one of the nice things about early parenthood is, you know, you're not going to have the energy to go out anyway. So what you spent on entertainment is likely to go down. So you'll have some savings there.
I don't spend much now.
Yeah. Where do you guys stand with retirement savings? How are you doing on that?
So we both have 403Bs.
Okay.
My husband has about 7 or 8 years invested in his, and I've only got about 2 or 3.
And how much are you putting in?
He's putting the maximum that gets matched. So okay. That's, I think, about 3 or 4%. I'm putting in 5 and I get matched at 2.5 at the moment.
I have a little bad news is you're not saving enough for retirement.
Right.
That really needs to be a much higher priority. You guys should be saving 10 to 15%.
Okay.
And it's going to be tough to juggle all this because you've got a new baby coming. But
right.
Your retirement must come first, as I said.
Even before the college savings?
Even before college savings because your child can get loans for school.
Right.
Nobody's you can't get loans for retirement.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's got to move up the food chain of your priorities.
Okay. I do have sort of one other question is right now we have some money saved that sort of qualifies as emergency funds, but also that we can sort of be flexible with. And is there anything we should put that into that will, you know, make more than our average sort of savings rate?
Here's the downside. If you need access to the money, if it needs to be liquid, you're not going to make very much money on it. You can go and look at online savings banks. They tend to have better rates than the brick and mortar banks.
Yeah, we're connected to ING.
Yeah. So you can look around for a better rate. But the reality is if you put it to work for you, it means locking it up in one way or another.
You really want it to be liquid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Well,
great questions.
So
and don't forget, you'll also have a new tax break next year. So.
Yes.
True. There's an upside.
many, many upsides. Enjoy your baby.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for questions today, Liz.
It was a lot of fun.
Well, thanks so much for being here. We are here to take all of your questions. Do give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or you can always write to us. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Liz, thanks again for the great advice.
Thank you, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Bank of America, which has begun a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low- to moderate-income communities. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Ladies, I'm sorry to say that according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, we still earn, on average, 20% less than men doing our same jobs. Now, part of the reason may be that studies show we are bad negotiators, and selling yourself short, even once, can set you back for the rest of your career. Reporter Ashley Milne-Tite talked with a few negotiators to explore the disparity.
So I have this friend named Nancy Barrow. She's dynamic, energetic, and confident. She works in a pretty ego-driven profession. She DJs a morning show at a radio station in Connecticut. You'd think she'd be the last person who'd have a problem asking for more money, but she hates it.
Whenever I go into an office with a boss and I have to sit and tell you why I'm worth money, it gives me such agita. Like, for weeks I stress about it, and for weeks I just get myself in a knot because I know I take it so emotionally that if you're not going to say yes to what I think I'm worth and why I should get paid that, I've gotten you all these great ratings and you're making more money. And if they told me no, I think I would cry in the office. And I know that's just, you know, the rule number one is you never cry in negotiations ever.
I have a couple of friends who actually have cried during negotiations. Nancy says just to make sure things never got that hairy in hers, about 10 years ago, she hired an agent to do the talking for her. She says in her industry, the guys are definitely paid more, and all her bosses have been male.
And I needed a male agent because I figured people take you more seriously when a male is representing you. And I'm sure that a lot of people are going to say that I'm very sexist in that situation. That's why I got myself a man, but I figured, you know, what better gun to get than a male gun to go up against another male? I felt that it really put me at an even playing field.
But is it ever really an even playing field? I've spoken to so many women who feel men come out of negotiations better than they do. It was time to find a boss to help me sort out why. Porter Bibb is managing partner of MediaTek Capital Partners in Manhattan. He has two female partners who he says wouldn't put up with less than their fair share. But he says, in general, female employees are far less likely than men to ask for a raise. And he says the majority of the women who have negotiated with him have accepted less than they could have got if they'd kept pushing.
Women don't have the, and this is my personal opinion, the forthright determination to protect their own interests when they're negotiating for themselves. Basically, they're great employees because they also understand the company's position that, oh, we can't afford to pay you anymore, that argument. And men would just say, look, I've got five other offers that, and I'm out of here if I don't get what I'm looking for. By and large, most women are not ego-driven to win the negotiation or to be as forward as men are. Men are much more competitive and egocentric.
Of course. I'd never really thought about that before, but once he said it, it made perfect sense. Most women I know are a lot less egotistical than the guys, even if they're as attractive and accomplished as Julia Dawson. She lives in New York, she's married, in her late 30s with a 9-month-old son. She works as a design director at a menswear company.
I'm just really shy standing up for myself at the end of the day. I think it's something that you're just not taught to do as a little girl, and I think, you know, for me, it just causes me a lot of anxiety because it basically says, hi, I think I'm worth this and I deserve this.
She dreads the back and forth so much, this year she went and found a therapist specifically to coach her on her negotiating technique.
And we would just kind of rehearse it like it was an act. And we would just go through and say, okay, well, what if she said this? And I said, well, I would feel this. And she's like, no, don't feel that. What would you say? And I was just like, well, I would say, you know, we kind of came back with the curveballs. Like, she would teach me what to say. What are the curveballs kind of thing?
Julia's husband, Steve, is sitting next to her on the couch as she describes all this. He works in finance for a multinational. He's sympathetic, but he thinks it should be pretty easy to get a raise if you deserve one.
I always try to negotiate on the basis of facts. I try to leave emotion out of it. People aren't interested in my personal situation. It's irrelevant as to whether or not I have a young child to support. What they're interested in is, do I deserve this pay rise? What value can I add to this particular group?
It all sounds very sensible, but it doesn't always work that way. Julia says she's dealing with managers who were stuck in the past, who see her the same way they did 10 years ago when she first started working there. Steve says it's up to her to change that by whipping out those good old facts.
You can say, well, look at my output, look at my record, you know, and you've done all of these things. I think you just need to be able to present or communicate it in a more structured fashion where you could say,
let's make a list.
In this particular division, you know, I was new in, you know, I've...
Julia did get her promotion, though the raise wasn't as big as she'd hoped. Her boss blamed that on the downturn. Julia says she may not enjoy negotiating, but she's glad she sought help to improve her tactics. It might be a good idea for the rest of us, and we should try to gag the nice girl so many of us were raised to be, the one who says, don't be too pushy. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
I wish my mom or grandma had shown me the ropes so I didn't feel like investing was such a masculine word.
Youth radio commentator and college senior Lauren Silverman.
Growing up, I watched my dad make most of the major money decisions. I remember my mom hunched over late at night at the dining room table, sorting through a stack of bills. But she was more of the bookkeeper. It was always my dad checking the portfolio, rebalancing the assets, reading the fine print. So now that I'm investing in the stock market, I'm happy I've already made progress. Not in the way of dollars and cents. I haven't made a ton of money. More like a percent or two. My goal right now is not just about making money, but understanding it. I want to become a financially independent woman. I've heard the legends about my grandma making a ton of money investing in Coca-Cola and General Motors. But I don't remember her ever uttering a word to me about her stock market miracles. And then again, she only started investing after my grandpa passed away and there was no alternative. There's nothing wrong with my grandpa or dad investing for the family. But I used to think that knowing how to balance a portfolio or read a cash flow statement was something that came with having someone male around. So I decided to change that for me. I started studying at Business Week's Online Learning Center and looking for financially savvy female role models, the Oprah Winfreys of the investing world. I stumbled upon a tutorial on the world's top investors on the Investopedia website. At first, I was excited to read the profiles, but then I discovered a pattern. Number one is a man. Number two, a man. Number three, yep, you guessed it, also a man. There was not a single woman included in the entire list of 20. But the thing is, in my research, I found plenty of financially successful and inspiring women, like Muriel Siebert. She's the first female to own a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. And there's Susie Orman. She's the famous financial advisor and motivational speaker. But none of them made nearly as much money as their male counterparts. And the truth is, that's fine with me. Investing doesn't have to be all about who can add the most zeros to a bank account. And it doesn't mean relying on a partner to make choices for you. My grandmother was a role model, but she kept quiet about her investments. I wish she didn't. I won't be like my grandma and pick up investing when I have to. The time to start is now, and I plan to make some noise.
Yeah, go for it. Lauren Silverman is a senior at the University of Michigan. Her commentary was produced by Youth Radio. We'd love to hear your thoughts on women and investing. Write to us at marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, if you're thinking about buying a foreclosed home, make sure you know its history.
This used to be the drama house in the neighborhood. A lot of stuff happened here. Law enforcement visited here. We didn't know any of that before we bought the house.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Tro. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yorp. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, working to solve America's retirement savings challenge through innovation, service, and performance. Putnam, a world of investing.
American Public Media.